And I want to present the first presenter today, who is Professor Senna De Silva, who is the current Director General of NACA, and Honorary Professor, Deakin University, Victoria, Australia, and has over 35 years' experience in many areas related to aquaculture development and inland fisheries management. He has worked in the academia in many parts of the globe, in Sri Lanka, UK, Singapore, and Australia for over 30 years, prior to taking up the current position at NACA in 2006, when he moved from his position as Professor of Aquatic Sciences, Deakin University. Professor De Silva has acted as a principal investigator and coordinated aquaculture-related projects in many Asian countries. And he has also coordinated the delivery of the first ever postgraduate course in aquaculture in the distance mode at Deakin University. He is currently a leading researcher recognized by peers for his contributions to inland fisheries, fish nutrition, and aquaculture, with over 250 publications in peer-reviewed journals. He has been senior author of 3 advanced texts and editor of many conference proceedings. He also serves on the editorial board of many journals and is the editor-in-chief of the newly launched journal, Reviews in Aquaculture. Professor De Silva has been the recipient of many international awards. I wish to introduce Professor to come and make his presentation. Thank you.
Sadiqaf, good morning to everybody. I feel a bit embarrassed getting on this podium many times, I must say. Okay, my talk is Climate Change Challenges Confronting Aquaculture. As you know, climate change has been an issue which has attracted global attention. Prime ministers have been made and unmade in the recent past, because of climate change issues. So it's a very political issue as much as a scientific issue. Climate change, perhaps the most intensive science-based reporting on a global issue. Climate change, some may disagree, but it's real and measurable in many forms. Global average surface temperatures increasing, global average sea level increasing, northern hemisphere sea cover decreasing. These are some indicators of climate change. It is thought that the recent anthropogenic activities is a major contributor to some of these changes. And the controversies still exist, however. What could climate change do? A few examples. Before I proceed with this, I apologize. My talk will be somewhat Asia-centric. I can't help it. 1 meter sea level rise, it is thought, will displace nearly 24 million people along certain river deltas like Ganges, Brahmaputra, Salween, Mekong, Yangtze, Yellow Rivers, and so forth. The above basin supports nearly 25% of humanity living. 2 meter rise in sea level will displace or uproot nearly 14 million people on the Mekong. Melting of Himalayan glaciers, which was recently a controversial issue again, will cause floods, there'll be erosion upstream, and these will lead to, for example, boosting the price of rice and so forth. In essence, problems of climate change impacts much greater on problems related to humanity than any other issue confronting the globe today. You can see certain many calamities we are facing all the time, weather havoc in all corners of the world. Some generalities on climate change impacts. Climate change impacts will decrease agricultural activities in the tropics and subtropics for almost any amount of warming, whether it's 1 degree, 2 degrees, or 3 degrees, it doesn't matter. 1/3 of the world's population is now subjected to water scarcity, which we heard from our keynote address in detail. And populations facing water scarcity will more than double over the next 30 years. An estimated 10 to 15% of the world's species would become extinct over the next 30 years. And what climate change will do is exacerbate some of these losses of biodiversity. It may not be the main cause of loss of biodiversity, but it will exacerbate the disappearance of species. Of course, in the same token, our food needs will increase because of the growing populations, which is expected to reach 9 billion by year 2050. Climate change, food security, and aquaculture is a continuum. You have climate change, food security, food supply, aquatic ecosystem impacts, and so forth. Food security, hunger and malnutrition, poverty, food insecurity, etc., and fisheries and aquaculture, fishing for feed or fishing for food, high trophic level aquaculture, low trophic level aquaculture, all these are in a continuum, each impacting the other. I'll go into some detail later. So basically, you have increasing vulnerability of food production system, communities, bringing about migration of communities, ecosystems will be impacted. And these, as a result of these, we have to have some adaptive measures and we have the challenges. And some of these adaptive measures and challenges have to be decided or mitigated through local policies. And then there is overall mitigating measures that will be at the policy level, at national, international, and globally. And that's how the climate change wheel will operate. Let me get on to climate change impacts on aquaculture. All cultured organisms are poikilothermic. And aquaculture is practiced in all climatic regions, tropical, subtropical, and temperate. Temperature ranges from 32 to 35 to 2 to 3 degrees. What these graphs show is the predominance of aquaculture in the tropics. This one is production. Production of fin fish, crustaceans, seaweeds, and mollusks. So the blue bars show what's produced in the tropics, and the red bars show you what's produced in the subtropics, and green the what's produced in the temperate regions. So basically, it is true that tropical regions is the main producer of aquaculture, but there is significant production of aquaculture commodities in subtropics and temperate regions, and challenges therefore will necessarily be varying. The challenges to each of the sectors in the tropics, subtropics, and temperate regions will vary from one to another, or will be different from one another. If you take climate change, some of the basic impacts, some of the basic parameters or factors of climate change that will influence aquaculture is temperature rise, sea level rise, rainfall and the seasonal pattern of rainfall, river flows, storm severity, wave surges, acidification, algal blooms, and enhanced stratification. All these will affect aquaculture. Some will have direct impacts, some will have indirect impacts, and in some cases it will be difficult to differentiate between indirect and direct impacts. That's the same, this part of the diagram. Let me look at some of the direct impacts initially in a very generalized way. Of course, production and yield, inability to farm, increased disease susceptibility, new diseases, calcification changes, physical damage, changes in spawning patterns, and fish kills from upwellings. Some of the indirect impacts, fish meal, fish oil supplies, trash fish supplies, ingredients and price escalations, loss of farming sites, acidification. And I also like to have a second order indirect impacts. It is very often mooted around that we heard about the fish meal trap or fish meal deficiencies that aquaculture will have to confront with. And one of the solutions often is suggested that we might be able to use large amounts of krill in the temperate waters. But the fact is, the krill biomass is one of the most climate change impacted biomasses, because it has been shown in no uncertain terms that the food of the krill, which is sulfids, are declining, and therefore the krill populations are declining. And let us also not forget the fact that krill is the main food for many whales species. So if you are going to take some of the krill from as a major source, as a fish meal substitute, we are going to confront many, many obstacles, particularly from the conservation group with an already declining krill population, therefore affecting the whales. So these are things that we have to keep in mind. Let me get on with some of the examples that I cited in a little more detail, if I may. Deltaic regions impacted by sea level rise, reduced water flow, and these will lead to saline water intrusion and potential floods. And here is the public sort of perceptions on deltaic regions. Of course, deltaic regions are simultaneously affected by subsidence. So deltaic regions are potentially highly significantly impacted. Deltaic regions in the tropics are hubs of aquaculture activities. In the Mekong Delta, we heard quite a bit, in Vietnam, home to the striped catfish sector, black tiger shrimp, Ganges and Brahmaputra in Bangladesh, home to shrimp culture. And here is the intensity of, say, catfish culture that occurs in the Delta. So case study, with your permission, I'll take striped catfish, one of my favorite topics. Possibly, as we heard many times, but I will repeat again, the biggest single species in a small geographical area. 1 to 2 million tons, worth $1 billion. 98% exported. Employs over 180 people, more than 80% women. How would climate change impact striped catfish farming? There is sea level rise, reduced river flow, salinity intrusion, impact on farming in 5 to 10 year time frame. What are the possible adaptations, or is there any adaptation that is possible to counteract or mitigate this increase in salinity? Move upstream? Probably not. Land prices are exorbitantly high. It involves a lot of capital expense, dislocation. So it's most likely to be the least probable and possible solution. Changes to new salinity-tolerant species possible needs fresh expertise, infrastructure changes, and of course markets have to be redeveloped. The other possibility is develop salinity-tolerant strains of striped catfish. Scientifically plausible, minor changes needed in hatcheries, basically in hatcheries only. So study the challenges in time scale, in time and space, look at all possibilities, adaptations, social and economic implications. The decisions, however, will finally come from the people at the coal face or the aqua face. The world needs this new substitute for the traditional whitefish, and the challenge is to keep this sector thriving in spite of this. There is a possible positive impact for the Deltaic regions likely to bring from climate change on aquaculture. Seawater intrusion will cause salinization of agricultural land, which is traditional agricultural activities such as rice farming. Is it going to be possible any longer with high increases in salinity? Mekong Delta, 2.5 grams per liter salinity intrusion, 20 to 35 kilometers upstream, the intrusion, loss of 70,000 hectares of three crops of rice farming area is expected. 100 centimeter sea level rise will bring about 40,000 square kilometers loss of land for rice farming. That will impact on 17.1 million people. Ganges Brahmaputra Delta, inundation of 2.5, it is predicted that 8,000 to 14,000 square kilometers will be affected by, 2,500, 8,000 and 14,000 square kilometers will be affected with a corresponding 0.1, 0.3 and 1 meter sea level rise respectively. So that's a huge amount of loss of land for rice cultivation, even with a 0.1 increase in the sea level rise. World Bank in 2000 reported a reduction of 0.5 million tons in rice production associated with 0.3 million level sea level rise. So what's the challenge to aquaculture? Can aquaculture provide alternative livelihoods to these rice farmers? My contention is possibly this could be the only way out to maintain those livelihoods. This is a positive challenge to aquaculture. Of course, it can be only met with suitable capacity building on alternating farming activity. Here we are suggesting that rice fish farmers be converted to fish farmers. A big transformation. Provide the necessary infrastructure, new hatcheries to meet increasing seed stock demands, marketing infrastructure, and so forth will be needed. It could be that we need to look for emerging species to meet the challenge. It could be that it's not the same species that we can promote the culture. Therefore, we'll have to make appropriate evaluations, decide on new suitable species where relevant. My contention is it's not too early to commence planning and modeling on these aspects. Commence discussion with stakeholders. The farmers have to be tuned. Their mindset has to be changed. Therefore, early intervention is needed. Prepare policy changes as required. Commence required capacity building. We are not talking of 30 years from now. We are talking roughly about 5 to 10 years from now. That's with the deltas. Temperature rise, which is a reality. This will bring about major challenges to cold water aquaculture in the temperate regions. Increased temperature will bring closer to upper range of tolerance of some cultured species. Dormant pathogens will become virulent. New diseases in new areas will appear. Example, Vibrio parahaemolyticus in oysters in Alaska and southern Chile. This is attributed to higher summer sea temperatures than normal. Abalone, Haliotis tuberculata, in Brittany and Normandy. Reproductive stress has exacerbated by higher temperature and the pathogen Vibrio hyae is getting established. Increased range in the distributions of pathogens will occur, such as the protozoan parasites, Perkinsus, Marianus, and so forth, in the Gulf of Mexico and Delaware Bay. So these are realities that we will have to face. Certain dormant pathogens will start to reestablish because of the high temperature and become virulent. And we have to be ready to counteract these changes in the ecosystem. So the challenges are develop higher temperature tolerant species, treatment for new diseases, better risk assessment on potential sites, or maybe even consider shift to other species. Temperature rise in tropical aquaculture. It's surprising, but it's an increasing occurrence. At times, it's associated with extreme weather conditions, changes in current patterns. In most tropical species, freshwater and marine, susceptible to temperature reductions of 3 to 5 degrees. Recent examples, there's been lots of grouper stocks in Thailand with a sudden decrease in temperature of 3 degrees. Loss of broodstock of tilapia in China. Of course, the challenge is there's very little we could do, but be alert and vigilant. Be prepared to move your stock if need be. Changes in rainfall and rainfall patterns in tropical system. In the tropics, the monsoonal rain patterns has an influence on reproductive seasonality. Most broodstock, even under aquaculture conditions, are subjected to natural cycles. They are outdoor, subjected to the elements. Challenges are research on changes on seasonality, relevant modifications to hatchery system, and fresh coordination plans with grow-out operations. When the reproductive cycle changes, your seed availability will change. Therefore, your grow-out systems has to accordingly change. And these changes had to be taken into account and preparations made for these changes. Natural productivity in inland waters. As we heard over the last few days, we use natural and quasi-natural waters for aquaculture, such as through culture-based fisheries in small water bodies. This is a community activity, effective secondary non-consumptive use of water resources. The only input is seed stock and is a low-cost rural activity which is expanding, particularly in Asia and some countries in South America, as we heard, Cuba too, and so forth. This system is totally dependent on weather pattern. The stocking, harvesting, the whole cycle is completely dependent on the weather pattern. And we are targeting 5 to 8 million tons of production from these systems. Challenges. Determine the impacts of potential changes on the water regimes. These can be modeled. Introduce selection criteria for the water bodies based on these modeling. To make adjustments in the production cycle, seed stock production, stocking and harvesting regimes, and the marketing channels have to be change accordingly. Changes in rainfall patterns, in tropical large inland water bodies. Large water bodies like lakes and reservoirs increasingly used for cage culture. I think this topic came up over and over again in some of the thematic sessions as well as in keynote addresses. There will be changes in productivity and stratification patterns. As Peter Edwards would always say, there will be algal blooms and fish kills. This is right. Increased upwelling. And now this is from Indonesia, Sirata watershed. You can see the concentration of cages in these coves. So number of factors have to be taken into account in the light of these changes in productivity and enhanced or exacerbated stratification patterns. Challenges. To maintain viability, do not intensify activities. Avoid minimized crowding. This is in, you can see the intensity. This is in Hainan Island. Maintain activity within the carrying capacity of the water body. Extra vigilance and continuous monitoring. Make sighting changes. It so happens everywhere we go in cage culture, in inland waters in particular, people tend to culture in these coves. Barry's here. That's because it's easy to access the services on land. Take the feed, get your provisions, but it has a terrible impact. And if these cages were moved into the mid-waters, not out of the caves where there is better water flow, possibly half of these problems could be avoided. And it's deeper water, and the upwelling may not be that impactive. Right. So these are things which we have to take into account and get ready in the coming years. General water stress, mostly in the tropics. We heard from the beginning of this conference, fresh water is one of the most limiting natural resources on this planet. Uneven distribution continent-wise. This is a graph with the blue bars show you total availability of water in each of the continents. Asia, if you take, has a huge amount of water. But if you take in Asia, the per capita availability is minuscule. There is so much competition of water because of the high population stress. So uneven distribution continent-wise, and also when you relate to population, this uneven distribution becomes even more significant. So the challenge is to conserve water and make sure that we plan our aquaculture activities accordingly. So the water abstraction reduced and better planned. Along rivers, introduce water abstraction and discharge calendars. By this I mean is, for example, in the Mekong River, Catfish Delta, if I may go back to it, you saw the intensity of the practices. Those practices have been sustainable up to now because there is so much of water, they can abstract and discharge as they want, individual farmers, but this can't go on forever. We will have a planned way of a calendar of discharge and intake over a sector of the over a river length. If that is not done, apart from water scarcity, there will be other problems coming up. So this has to be done on a community or cluster basis. The other bringing about other advantages. Reduce disease-wide disease spreading, increase productivity, and so forth. The other one is recirculation technology. We talk about recirculation technology very much. There are two forms of recirculation technology, if I may have a drink of water. We have to make them more efficient. We have to remember that ultimately our aim is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions on unit of production. I would encourage, particularly in tropical and subtropical region, simple outdoor recirculation technologies. So cost effective, reduce greenhouse gas emissions per unit of production, useful byproducts. Yesterday we spoke about somebody, Artemia biomass. These pictures depict the fifth generation SPF broodstock production in an outdoor recirculating system just 30 kilometers out of Bangkok. In Thailand, there are about 30 to 40 of such units operating very effectively. So we need not necessarily have this high-tech, high-cost, high-energy costing recirculation systems. These can be done outdoors at a low cost with minimal, easily maintainable, and you can also end up with byproducts which are useful for as food for fish. Or this particular farm, I might say, exports daily 100 kilograms of live Artemia biomass direct to Hong Kong for the aquarium trade. So it's a sub-product from his system. This is what should be encouraged. Not energy-intensive system, but systems that are using less energy. Extreme weather conditions manifested in many forms. Wave surges, storms, extreme unseasonal cold bursts, and so forth. These are the elements which have the greatest difficulty in predicting. Here we have to have more adaptabilities than challenges. Better infrastructure, understand the risks, take precautionary steps. Example, increase dike height. Be prepared to move stocks. Socioeconomically, embrace such insurance, for example, so that at least your business can start after an unpredicted calamity. These are from India after a typhoon, I can't remember the name of it, but the destruction is enormous. And poor farmers need to restart their business once it settles, and the only way is probably have embrace insurance. Fish meal and fish oil. We have heard this over and over again over the last 3 days. Aquaculture utilizes 45% and 85% of global fish meal and fish oil production, respectively. Reduction industry has become a bone of contention. Is it ethically correct to use nearly 25% of world marine fish production for fish meal production and fish meal and fish oil production? Should this resource not be used for direct human consumption to reduce malnutrition? Currently estimated at 1 billion people or 17% of the world's population. These are some of the Millennium Development Goals, is to reduce this to by half by 2015. This graph shows you the amounts of total fish, the amount used for reduction in green, and percentage reduction is about 20 to 25%. South America and Europe dominate and lead the reduction industry. Main raw material, we heard number of speeches before, pelagic industrial fisheries like Peruvian anchovy, capelin, sand eel, and so forth. There has been a gradual reduction in the raw material usage, as this graph shows. General reduction in fish meal and fish oil is occurring now. Raw material in the past has been very much fluctuating. And what are the climate change impacts likely to be on raw material supplies? There is a predicted reduction in ocean productivity in the North Atlantic by 50%, others by roughly 20%. Then there will be the El Nino effects. The Peruvian anchovy supplies will be affected. Then there is a North Atlantic Oscillation Winter Index. Sand eel production, which is exclusively used for fish meal, is going to be impacted on. So the bottom line is reduced raw material supplies from CC impacts, renewed and more vigorous social pressures on the reduction industry, escalating costs, placing those cultures at the brink of economic collapse. So challenge to aquaculture, as we heard over and over again, reduce dependence on fish meal and fish oil soon and fast. So the traditional approaches have been develop feeds with less fish meal and fish oil, use more agricultural byproducts, better use of the meat industry processing waste or the rendered products, improvements to feed management, develop new technologies, genetic modification, reduce capabilities to elongate and desaturate the long chain fatty acids. Most challenging is the need for a paradigm shift, a change, and this is linked to other social aspirations. It's paradigm shift. This is a reproduction from our book in Success Stories, where we try to divide the phase, the aquaculture sector's growth over the last few years into a number of phases. The important thing is we are around here, 2010. Right now, we need to ensure minimal impacts on biodiversity and ecosystem approach to production. Around here only, we've started seeing labeling on our products in the supermarket. In these periods, we never saw that. So we changed into that, and our prediction is very soon, the certification labels that we all talk about will not be that it's antibiotic free, it's this one free. The label that people will be looking for will be how much of greenhouse gases did it was emitted in the production of 1 kilogram of food. That will be the key. That will be the label change in 10 years' time. And then we have to be ready for that. So by 2020, consumers will be more concerned about the greenhouse gas emissions in production of 1 kilogram of food. Challenge to aquaculture, shift to low trophic species. Even now we know 60%, 65% of the produce is low trophic. There needs to be a global approach, however. Make aquaculture the most GHG-friendly animal protein production sector. And these figures show how the developing countries, the pyramid is one way, and in developed countries, pyramid is other way. So these are the global trends in aquaculture production expressed in weighted mean trophic level by economic country groupings, including China. Perhaps an overall an assessment of CC impacts on aquaculture may be an appropriate starting point. I reproduced this from Dalbury and Allison, where they have done a very good study on the impacts of climate change on fisheries. They have pinpointed there is a recognition of very low impacts, low and so forth, a sort of semi-quantitative scaling so that people can get prepared. Maybe aquaculture will have to do that on a global scale as a starting point. So the take-home message, certain aquaculture systems in different locations have to make adaptive changes. Through changes in farming systems, make relevant technological innovations for some. aquaculture may also be an option to millions of other primary producers whose livelihoods are at risk. Aquaculture has to make the hard decision to bring about a paradigm shift. If the above challenges are met, with effectively aquaculture may become the least GHG emitting food production in the sector. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Professor, for that very good presentation. I'm sure we all agree that climate change is a major challenge for all of us, and especially more so for fisheries and aquaculture.